From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, national thought leaders are discussing the climate for renewables in Wisconsin today. We'll get a taste of that conversation. Later, how has the paradigm changed for Wisconsin's Indian nations in recent years? One expert says simple recognition has improved.
Surrounding municipalities are starting to understand that there is another layer of government between municipal government, state government, U.S. government. Now we're reminded that there are tribal governments as well.
And Irish stand-up comic Dylan Moran looks across the Atlantic for material.
Not everybody's talking about Britain or France or Japan, you know, but everybody talks about America because if you scratch your left ear, it has big consequences all around the world.
Lake Effect comes your way next after this news update. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for being with us today. The drive towards including more renewables in the state energy portfolio has been going in fits and starts. Incentive programs for solar, wind, and biomass have come and gone, though individual communities such as Milwaukee continue to encourage and promote the conversion to renewable fuels. Today in Madison, local government leaders and members of the state's renewable energy community will address some current challenges in the industry. The third annual Renew Policy Summit will feature two national thought leaders in the area. Carl Robigo was an assistant secretary of energy in the Clinton administration and now runs an Austin, Texas-based consulting firm. Dr. Dan Arvizu is director of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, or NREL, in Golden, Colorado. Robigo tells WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz that he believes this is a magical time for solar energy.
What's going on in solar today is a convergence of a whole lot of interesting things. First of all, we've got falling prices. We've got consistent public political support, meaning this is probably the most charismatic energy technology that we've seen in a long time. We've got some innovative financing coming. So we've got capitalism coming to the game, innovative financing, clever business models, smart young people wanting to work on it. We're not just depending on old folks like me, you know, but rather new minds are entering it and have the opportunity because of the fast-paced way in which businesses can work, organize, and go into business, bringing new ideas.
This is Dan. I'm certainly a big fan of I think, the potential that solar brings. I think it's still relatively immature. I mean, there are certain things you can do with solar today that just make absolute great sense to do, and we should be doing them. Solar hot water heating, solar lighting. In terms of converting it to electricity and using it as a source that competes, say, with the fossil fuels, we still have some development to do. But I'm very, very bullish on the idea that solar will be a huge piece of the future energy system. And I think what we've seen is some breakthroughs, certainly in the cost of solar coming down and in the fact that people are now pretty much focused on the fact that they know that it'll be a particularly important source in the future. And so in that sense, it's kind of had a coming out party, you know, in the marketplace, but it's still a relatively small fraction of our overall energy consumption. And over time, that'll change. And I'm convinced that it'll be probably the most dominant of all the renewable energy sources.
You have a vision of a future society that's powered largely by renewable sources. When do you think we're going to start to see more of that? And looking nationwide.
Yeah, you know, I'm the eternal optimist, and I've been in this business, it's been decades now. When I think about the future, what I think about is we really do need to have an energy system transformation. That's why I start with the premise that we need this transformation to an energy system that is much more sustainable than the one we have today. The one we have today simply will not meet the needs of the future for this country. And the best way to talk about what the future will look like is say, you know, the attributes of that future energy system is going to be the things that we all care about. It's going to be affordable, it's reliable, resilient, it's safe and secure, it's accessible to all folks, and it's environmentally very benign, very friendly. My expectation is that in that future system, we're going to see a lot greater attention to efficiency, we're going to see a lot more renewable energy and distributed resources of all kinds, And probably the biggest change that I think we'll see is that the energy customers will be active participants in the commerce of energy. So rather than having a few incumbent providers like we have today that provide, you know, essentially electrons or fuel, we're going to have a system where actually the consumer might actually be a participant as a provider of energy as well. And there'll be a bigger premium on things that I'm calling ancillary energy services, which really relate to, you know, providing capacity value, stability, voltage and frequency regulation and storage and a variety of other things that in the future will have a value to them that's much different than what we have in our present energy system. So to me, the future is really exciting because what it looks like is that there's an opportunity for a whole lot of new innovation. And that's where I get particularly encouraged. Even though it will take some time to actually develop, I think it's a future that's pretty exciting and can do a lot of the things that we have always hoped that our system would do, create jobs, economic growth, competitiveness, and really be an engine for economic development and future standard of living, prosperity, those kinds of things.
So, Carl, let me jump into Wisconsin because, of course, you're speaking at the Renew Policy Summit. What is your, from the outside looking in, assessment and advice going to be, or message going to be?
That's always a risk. It's always a risky thing to be an outsider, but I start with the foundation, which is that Wisconsin has a great tradition of thinking innovatively. They've had this renewable standard and energy efficiency goals, and there is some innovation. There was a tradition of this interesting way in which the sort of the populism that people think of Wisconsin as being meets the clean energy frontier. You've got the fact that the state is not endowed with the traditional sources of energy. It's not rich in natural gas or coal. It doesn't have uranium mines or mountains for a lot of hydropower. If it wants to stop being dependent on other people, it's going to have to develop its own resources. And I think there has been some good effort, and those resources, including the demand side resources, energy efficiency, conservation, smarter use of energy, as well as solar, which, you know, Wisconsin has plenty of, geothermal and other resources that it could be developing as opposed to, you know, sort of sending all the money away to other people for their fuel. Recently, I think that there have been some indicators of stalling, and in some cases, people would say even going backwards. This is the time when the state could energize the business opportunities around clean energy even more by pushing to raise the standard. Wisconsin's at the point now where its previously ambitious goals now look to be a ceiling against opportunity. And that's not what you should do. What can I say? In summing it all up, I think that Wisconsin now has the decision in its hands, whether it wants to build on a good tradition and strengthen that and reap the benefits in terms of business, economic development, clean energy, resilience, energy security, or sit on its laurels and let somebody else take the leadership position. One of the things, you know, that's fascinating to me is that Minnesota doesn't have, for example, much better solar. I spent a lot of time. Doesn't have much better sun than Wisconsin, but it's got solar manufacturers, and it's got a standard, and it's got people organizing around a market. I get phone calls from people saying, I want to go do business in this market opportunity that is Minnesota. I don't get those calls about Wisconsin. And I think what's on the table now, with the way renewable energy, energy efficiency, energy management, smart grids are bursting out, is that, let me put it this way, it's not a question of if, it's a question of when we will be using a lot more solar, a lot more energy efficiency technology, a lot more energy management and smart grid technology. It's not a question of if, it's a question of when. It is also a question of who's going to reap the benefit. And those benefits go to the leader. Those who make themselves a market and an opportunity will get the business and the jobs. Those who do not will be customers of the states that led. And that's the fundamental question in front of Wisconsin right now.
This is Dan. In terms of what's necessary in most of the country, some of the basics are not being done. And that's really where I tend to focus, is that where I applaud those that are pushing the envelope. There's a lot of stuff that just makes economic sense today that we don't do.
You're talking about energy efficiencies and
building codes and efficiency in vehicles. And just, you know, again, efficiency is the low-hanging fruit. Everybody's said that. You know, why we as a country don't rally around that is hard to imagine. You know, we simply haven't made the case properly for the public to get behind it. But it just makes a lot of sense. And I'll talk about some examples that we have on our campus. You know, we have a new facility that we've just built here. We host 1,350 people in our what we call our research support facilities. It's net zero energy. It generates on an annual basis as much energy as it consumes. The average desktop energy usage of every one of our employees in this building is 70 watts. Think about your own desktop. Your computer by itself is typically 300 watts. And we're doing all, it's a living laboratory. We're doing all kinds of things that just make sense. Here's the best part. We built this building, including the PV panel, for less than what a building is built to code in this Colorado area. Now, that's pretty amazing. People don't believe you can do that stuff. But it didn't cost us any extra. It cost us less than a building built to code. Given that we know we can do it, why don't we just do it with everything? Those are more cultural and awareness issues than they are anything else. So, you know, I figure if the National Renewable Energy Lab isn't a place where you can come and see the technology at work that we're talking about, seeing us actually do it, then we're probably not as good an ambassador, not doing our job as well as we could have. And this is an opportunity, I think, and why I like to speak to folks who are anxious to find out what can they do, is to say, look, there's a way to blend all these things together and get a value today if you just have the will and the vision to make that happen.
So will that be the heart of your message when you speak in Madison?
It is. I think, you know, again, I'm very much on the think long term and strategically, but act locally and try to figure out what are the no regrets policies or no regrets approaches to options that we have in front of us to work on. That will seed a lot of both interest and for me, it's really about educating the next generation of practitioners, certainly in the fields that relate to clean tech or relate to renewable energy, because these things will take time. And to a large degree, you know, those of us that are getting longer in the tooth, you know, I think our time is past in the sense that we're probably not going to be able to see all the transformations that are necessary, but the next generation is going to have to live with this. And we need people out there that are actually, that caught the vision, that understand that. So education and awareness of the next generation to me is one of the most important things that I can do. It's in that context of showing the way, showing that these things are possible, that gives us encouragement to continue to recognize and do the things that are necessary to get to the long-term outcomes that we're focused on. So, you know, don't be discouraged. It's a long-term deal, and there's lots of things to be optimistic about. Technology opportunities are just absolutely phenomenal, and I'll focus on some of those things that are in the offering, you know, later in the maturity cycle, that are going to be revolutionary. Maybe they won't happen today, won't happen overnight, but in time, we will see those things, I think, making bigger contributions.
Carl Robigo was an assistant secretary of energy in the Clinton administration and now runs a Texas-based consulting firm. Dr. Dan Arvizu is director of the National Renewable Energy Laboratory in Colorado. They spoke with Susan Bentz. The third annual Renew Policy Summit runs through this afternoon at UW-Madison. Coming up, a revised edition of a book on Wisconsin's Indian nations captures their modern history. That's next on Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. It's Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. A decision by Governor Scott Walker is still pending as to the future of a proposed Menominee Tribal Casino in the Kenosha area. The plan, which also includes a partnership with Hard Rock International, is strongly opposed by the Potawatomi tribe. It says the project would take away business from its Milwaukee casino. For UW-Madison Professor Patty Lowe, the casino debate is just one of the modern challenges facing Wisconsin's tribes. But as she's documented in her book, Indian Nations of Wisconsin, they've also endured and made great advancements in just the last several decades. The book is now in its second edition. Patty Lowe explained to Lake Effect Stephanie Lecce why she believed the book deserved an update.
A couple of reasons. I had serious regrets almost immediately after the first edition was written because I didn't have a chapter on urban Indians, and more than half of all Native people in Wisconsin live in Milwaukee, Madison, Green Bay, and other urban areas in Wisconsin. So it was a serious omission on my part, I'm afraid. And then when I originally wrote the book, the first edition, the Brother Town were sort of awkwardly piggybacked onto the Mohican chapter because there was very little known about them. They were just beginning the federal acknowledgement process. They were terminated back in the 1830s and have been attempting to be a federally recognized tribe ever since then. And it wasn't until the last decade, that effort got some traction. And so now there was material in order to justify a complete chapter on the Brother Town.
Obviously, each tribe has experienced different things, but have you noticed in the last 13 years certain trends in terms of what the different tribes throughout Wisconsin have been experiencing?
Well, certainly with the Ojibwe, the big challenge has been mining. And back in the mid-1990s, the Mole Lake Ojibwe or Sokagon Ojibwe and the Forest County Potawatomi and to a lesser extent, the Menominee and Oneida were facing a large sulfide copper mine. And those tribes, in connection with a lot of mainstream environmental groups, were able to meet that challenge. And in fact, the Potawatomi and the Mole Lake actually purchased the mine site in order to prevent that area from becoming a sulfide mine. Currently, the Bad River Ojibwe are facing a massive open pit taconite mine at the headwaters of their Rice River. And so mining especially is something that quite a number of the tribes are very concerned about. The other issue that I think is a common theme is the land into trust issue. All of the tribes have experienced that, but probably the Oneida, for them, that issue has been perhaps more contentious than it has been for other tribes.
Well, what does that mean, land into trust?
What it means is the Oneida have been buying back land that was originally part of their reservation and putting that land as they are entitled to back into trust through the Bureau of Indian Affairs. And reservation land is not taxable. And so the land that passed out of their hands because of the Allotment Act in the 19th century, the Oneida lost more than 90% of their land. And so now they've been buying it back and putting it back into trust while that land is coming off municipal tax rolls and increasing the burden, individual tax burden for non-Indians in those municipalities where that land has come from. So this has been an issue. And the way the Oneida have met it is to negotiate service agreements, you know, paying for roads or paying for police or fire protection or those kinds of municipal services in order to ease the tax burden on individual mainstream taxpayers.
What do both of these issues, both the land into trust and the environmental concerns, tell us about how Indian tribes are organizing and their political agency today in Wisconsin?
Well, certainly the recognition of sovereignty and treaty rights, something that really began in the 1970s and really we're seeing it now, and the acknowledgement of municipalities like Brown County and the city of Green Bay in just simply referring to the Oneida Nation as the sovereign Oneida Nation. Surrounding municipalities are starting to understand that there is another layer of government between municipal government, state government, U.S. government. Now we're reminded that there are tribal governments as well. And so it tells us that Native communities are beginning to flex some of that political muscle. But because there's so much pushback and backlash in some cases, especially surrounding environmental issues, it tells me that Native communities perhaps haven't gotten to the level where the communication is flowing as well as it should be.
We're talking with Patty Lowe about the second edition of her book, Indian Nations of Wisconsin. Patty, you include a new chapter in this edition on urban Indians. Why do they need their own chapter?
I think because the urban experience for Native people is a unique one. It's a pan-Indian environment. You have people from tribes all over the country who are trying to retain their identity as Native people. However, they don't have access to the services that their tribal nations would normally provide for them. Health, education, welfare, all those things that we as citizens, whether you're a Native citizen or a U.S. citizen or a state citizen, enjoy in our lives. And Native people don't have access to that in many cases. And so they've had to create a different kind of social network and social service network in Milwaukee, as an example, because there's certainly Native people living in Madison and Green Bay and Eau Claire and La Crosse and many other urban areas. But imagine in the 1950s, your family arrives because you've answered an ad basically from the Bureau of Indian Affairs that tells you, come, move to the city. And you see the brochure has beautiful gleaming skyscrapers and happy Native people doing mainstream type jobs. And you've been promised that you'll get job retraining and that your life in the city is going to be wonderful. And instead, basically what you have is a one-way bus ticket to the center of town and directions to a flop house. And there are no services. And now not only, you know, are you cut off from your tribal services, but you're cut off from your culture and your language and your ceremonies. And it's been a real struggle for Native people. And, you know, we do see some successes because of organizations like the American Indian Chamber of Commerce and the First American Capital Corporation and some of the other economic engines that we've seen come up, you know, grow in Milwaukee. Indian Summer Festival, more than anything for me, really embodies how far urban Indians have come. That now there's this three-day festival that attracts thousands, tens of thousands of people celebrating traditional and contemporary Native music, art, food, fellowship. And, you know, if I can get just a little personal, my mother, who has lived in Milwaukee most of her life, told me she cried after that first Indian Summer Fest because, you know, for so long she was made to feel like she should be embarrassed and apologized for her Native identity. And here, you know, this celebration of Native culture, you know, for the first time as an urban Indian made her feel proud. And, you know, I think that's not an overstatement. I think a lot of Native people of her generation really, really look at festivals and celebrations, the resurgence of powwows, and festivals like Indian Summer that really are a great source of pride for them.
For as many successes as the tribes in Wisconsin have had, there still permeates throughout the media stories of where there are struggles when it comes to health care, issues with alcoholism, low employment rates. What is the situation? What is the real situation on the ground for tribes here in Wisconsin? Where are the struggles? Where are the successes? And where are the tribes really making strides toward improving the situation of Natives both on reservation lands and also within our urban communities?
That's such a good question, and it really speaks to the title of the book, Histories of Endurance and Renewal, because there have been successes. I think some of the tribes have experienced some economic success. We're seeing good housing starts. We see tribal programs expanding. There are daycare programs and Head Start programs, there are elder programs, elder housing, Meals on Wheels. There's a really strong sense of land stewardship and a lot of programs involving brownfields, let's say, you know, with St. Croix. They've done a lot of reclamation of brownfields. There are media centers like those at Le Couderay. The Forest County Potawatomi are almost completely off the grid because of a really very visionary energy program that the tribe has instituted over the past, I'd say, 6 or 7 years. The Menominee, there's this resurgence of their sturgeon ceremonies, and their forest is as healthy as any forest on the planet. So there's some things that are really great positive things that I think tribal nations in this state can be really proud of. But there are those challenges. Diabetes is a huge problem. In some of the native communities, almost 60% of the population over age 50 is either diabetic or pre-diabetic. I mean, that's an incredible challenge. Child obesity is a major problem. Some tribes have better access to health care than others. That's still a challenge for Native people who live off the reservation and perhaps not in an urban area like Indians in Milwaukee who have access to the Ignace Health Center. So these are some of the vestiges of land loss and really generational trauma, I think, caused by the boarding school experience. Beginning in the late 19th century, you had tens of thousands of Native children who were removed from their homes, placed in government facilities or Christian boarding schools. It was illegal for them to practice their religions or speak their language or maintain any of their culture. And, you know, some of these children, my grandfather, for example, was taken at age 4. And their education really, I think you could argue, was a second-class education. And so, you know, you take these children out of their environment at age 4 and you give them a problematic education, and then they go back into their communities. They don't speak the language. They haven't experienced, you know, what it's like to be a member of a family and be shown love and show love and affection. And now these people grow up and they become parents, and they, you know, that they don't have that good foundation for a solid family life. They've been told to be ashamed of being Indian, and so that brings with it all the, you know, the drinking and drug problems as people try to just sort of self-medicate and not deal with a fundamental issue like that. So, you know, we're making strides, but we still have these very real problems that we're trying to come to grips with.
What do you see will continue to be issues, and where do you think strength will grow?
Well, I'm an optimist. So the fact that tribes are reasserting their sovereignty and beginning to really act like nations and do what nations do, which is to provide for their people and protect their natural resources, I think we'll see more of that going forward. I think that the gaming operations that provided a first tier of economic infrastructure, now some of the tribes are beginning to spin off and create a second tier of economic infrastructure. We're starting to see that those secondary businesses, and hopefully we'll continue to see an improved quality of life on all of our reservations.
You mentioned the gaming industry, and I know that one of the big stories going on right now is the contention between the Potawatomi and their casino here in Milwaukee, and the Menominee's plan to build another casino in Kenosha. What do you make of that situation?
Well, I think it was a very deliberate attempt by the state to drive a wedge between the tribes. When you say we'll only allow another casino, but no new net casino, so somebody has to give up a casino and everybody has to agree, well, that wasn't going to happen. And I think everyone knew it wasn't going to happen. And so I think it was kind of a disingenuous path to take. Certainly the Potawatomi are trying to protect their own economic interests in the southeast eastern part of the state, and the Menominee Casino in Kenosha, from the Potawatomi perspective, would be seen as considerable competition. looking at it from the Menominee perspective, this is a tribe that was improperly terminated in the 1950s, and they are still trying to recover from termination. And it, you know, the Menominee are one of the most economically challenged tribes. So certainly as that tribe moves forward to try to provide as best it can for its people, it's going to be looking at opportunities to do that. And the, you know, the old dog track in Kenosha is a means to an end. Tribes are not monolithic. They're culturally distinctive. They're linguistically distinctive. They have different histories. They've got different economic challenges. And so to expect them to all react the same way on any issue, I think, is just not realistic.
Well, Patty Lowe, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Patty Lowe is the author of Indian Nations of Wisconsin, Histories of Endurance and Renewal, published by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. She's an enrolled member of the Bad River Band of Lake Superior Ojibwe and a professor at UW-Madison. She spoke with Stephanie Lecce in October. As Patty Lowe mentioned earlier, she included a lot of new information she hadn't known into the second edition of her book on the Indian Nations of Wisconsin. As she learned more about our state's tribes, she realized there was much she hadn't known. It's a situation we're all familiar with. No matter how much learning we do, there is still going to be information we don't know. Essayist Dr. Bruce Campbell can relate as he goes about teaching the surgeons of the future.
My most vivid memory of medical training is the pressure we felt to learn everything that was set before us. When I was just beginning my residency, a volunteer faculty member offered to let me assist removing a tumor from a patient's parotid gland, one of the major spit glands in the cheek. I was anxious to work with this teacher because he had trained 40 years before at one of the world's most prestigious residency programs. As we scrubbed, the faculty member carefully explained the steps of the operation to me. The work is tricky because the nerve that controls the facial muscles runs right through the middle of the gland. The initial step in performing the surgery is to safely identify and protect the nerve. He crafted the incision and created a narrow 1-inch tunnel in front of the ear that ran from the skin down to where he expected to find the nerve. I looked in. It was hard to see anything at all. Blood and fluid repeatedly obscured the view. "Here," he said, "watch this carefully. This is the most critical step." And so I watched. He pushed and he prodded. He opened spaces between the tissues with a small spreading device. Things did not go well. He noted that there was more bleeding than usual. The patient was large and the tunnel needed to be longer than he expected. He repositioned the spreading device over and over, first aiming more superiorly and then more inferiorly. I could sense that he was not happy. Finally, after several minutes of anxious searching, retracting, stretching, and straining, there it was, the facial nerve. He poked it gently with a nerve stimulator, and the patient's cheek jumped. "There you have it," he announced. "That's how you find the nerve." I dutifully noted what he had just shown me. That night I wrote down the steps of the procedure for later reference. The approach I had witnessed seemed perfectly logical. I worried, however, that the initial steps had been so difficult and the risk to the nerve so high that I might never be able to duplicate what I had just been shown. A few months later, I scrubbed with a different surgeon on the same operation. He, too, told me that the critical first step involved finding and protecting the nerve. I looked for the spreading device I had seen to create the narrow dark tunnel during the first procedure, but there was none. Before I had a chance to ask the surgeon whether he would need the spreader, he created the same incision, but then took a long, wide, and well-lit approach to the nerve, carrying the dissection down to the nerve with a broad front rather than the narrow tunnel I had seen the first time. Before long, he had safely found the nerve, and the procedure was off and running. Suddenly, I could see myself being able to someday master this operation. I asked him, "Why did the other surgeon use such a limited approach to the nerve?" "Perhaps," the second surgeon replied, "that was the way he was taught, and he never learned another way." Someone wise once commented, "Half of what we teach medical students is wrong. We just don't know which half." Innovation and technology are constantly pounding on the physician's door. There is always some new medication, approach, or technology. Many of these latest and greatest things will soon disappear. I am certain that there are many, well, perhaps half of the things that I teach today's students and residents that will eventually be sources of laughter and wonderment in a couple of generations. I wish I knew which half. My only hope is that they will be gentle with me.
Lake Effect essayist Dr. Bruce Campbell is a head and neck cancer surgeon at Frederick Hospital and the Medical College of Wisconsin. He also writes about his experiences in his blog, Reflections in a Head Mirror. We'll revisit our interview with Irish comedian Dylan Moran when Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. If you set out to name five current stand-up comedians, the name Dylan Moran might not make your list, unless you are a fan of the 2004 cult movie hit Shaun of the Dead or the somewhat more obscure BBC television show Black Books, which had a three-season run a decade ago. Despite his dabbling in movies and TV, Irish comedian Dylan Moran remains a staple of the stand-up circuit on a global level. His humor is observational, things like relationships and culture, with the obvious additional perspective of an outsider looking at American life. Here is just a sample.
Because they're afraid of a woman's contempt. And women, as a group, en masse, do show contempt for men, en masse. Now, a woman might be afraid of an individual violent man, which is very sensible. Everybody should be afraid of an individual violent man. But as a group, you hear a lot of contempt about men. Oh, look! Look at them. Look, there they go. One of them is trying to do something.
Moran was in Milwaukee last fall for a show at Turner Hall, and the stand-up comedian sat down with our own in-house resident yuckster Dan Harmon and talked about his early days in the business.
Well, before I did Black Books, I was a circuit stand-up in London, where you have to go to learn how to do it, really. I was there for about 4 years, and so doing sometimes 2-3 shows a night all over the city, jumping on buses, jumping in cabs to get to the next show. And it's noisy and rowdy, and you have to do a lot of crowd control, and you have to be sort of tolerant and not afraid of failing, because that happened, you know, a few times. It does if you're doing probably, I don't know, hundreds of performances a year. And, you know, you get toughened up and you get used to shouting at people and being shouted at and not really minding too much. And everybody does it for a couple of years and then they want to get the hell out of there. And you really do, because when I began, there were names who were doing it had been doing it for 10 or 15 years. And when I left, they're still doing it. And I see their names, some same names in their lists. And that was kind of the thing you were afraid of. You didn't want to stay on that circuit, because you can. There are cases where you just don't get out. So my agent said to me, come on, write something. And I submitted a script for a sitcom festival, and then people liked it. It got picked up. We made people laugh. They said, okay, let's make this program. I mean, that was it. You know, there was no big run-up. There was no plan. I never had a plan.
Nor did you have a desire to be a bookstore owner or work.
No, that idea just came from spending quite a lot of time in these places and noticing that all the guys who were in there looked like they just had some sort of, you know, digestive problem.
All right. Well, I don't know. Maybe it played sort of a prominent role in the series, but I just want your take on how much drinking and alcohol plays a part in your comedy.
Well, you know, I grew up in Ireland in the 70s, so these were unreconstructed times. This is before. It's not like America where, you know, there's health warnings on plastic spoons saying plastic spoons can damage your health if you stick them in your ear. Ireland was one of those places where people routinely imbibed huge quantities of alcohol and then flung themselves into cars to do long and arduous cross-country journeys. So that was just part of the culture. Different times. And it was around, you know, it's part of the culture, it's around, and it was also around in those sort of semi-bohemian or rackety environments in London, where a lot of those bookshops were too, you know, kind of a down at heel seedy, not very competitive or glamorous or success-led kind of way of living, just people trying to inch along to the next day or the next week. And blotting themselves out with cheap Spanish red wine at the end of the day.
So how much of that character was you?
You use bits of yourself in it, whatever you're doing, but when it comes to those characters, you know, they're so heightened, they're so exaggerated. It's a character. You know, this is very important to understand. I'm sometimes surprised people still ask, you know, how much of it is you, because, yes, you know, I've got black hair or brown hair or whatever color my hair is, and I sit in chairs and I read and I can drink some wine, but there's not a huge crossover because the character's nuts. If you lived like that, you'd be dead very quickly.
Well, I mean, did it give you a chance to further hone your craft, I guess? I mean, completely different style of writing than stand-up?
Yeah, well, I'd always been writing different things. I'd always been writing bits of prose and bits of plays and all kinds of stuff, you know, so I wasn't starting from nothing, you know? It gave me a chance to work with great people. And because I was so involved in the making of the program and because I was worried about the scripts and would these jokes go over and so on, I didn't worry about acting. I was never very interested in acting, to be honest. I never thought about it very much. I just sort of turned up and tried to make sure that we hit the jokes the way they were intended to work. So it meant that I was relaxed about performing because I was too worried about the show, if you know what I mean.
Well, it looks like you guys had a lot of fun doing it, though.
We did have a lot of fun doing it. I mean, I was very lucky. You know, I was working with really stellar talents there with Bill and Tams, and they're exceptional people.
Well, you just mentioned acting. So did it give you a further opinion of whether or not you wanted to keep doing stand-up? I mean, obviously you have kept doing it since then.
Yeah, that's because I like eating. And and being able to buy socks, you know. I wouldn't exaggerate the level of choice I have in all of this. You know, one has to live. And look, it's a really interesting way to live. You get to travel around. If it wasn't for what I do, I would never have ended up in Milwaukee, for instance. I would never have had a chance to walk your empty, empty, lonely streets.
All right. Well, it's just my opinion anyway, and I don't know. I think comedians are uniquely qualified to comment on culture. You have to be a cultural observationalist. So what are your current observations?
Well, I'm looking at where I am and what's going on. So obviously my head is full of America at the moment, trying to figure out why it's working or not working the way it is just at present. It does seem to be in a really interesting, if crazy, phase with your very infantile obstructionist politics going on. I'm not sure how much longer that can last. The Republicans are in a deeply hilarious phase as far as I'm concerned. They're more and more extreme, more and more aggressive, and less and less forthcoming with anything that resembles an idea. So I just want to see how far they can take it. I mean, fully expecting people to be jumping up and down and tearing off their shirts and throwing them across the room quite soon.
It seems like you haven't really spent too much time focusing on American culture, American politics in your stand-up routines. Some of it, but I'm wondering if...
Yeah, well, I'm especially interested in, not exclusively, but especially interested in sort of, you know, how we see each other from across the Atlantic, or how Americans think of the other parts of Europe, apart from Britain and Ireland. And, you know, everybody talks about America. That's probably one of the unique aspects of the country. Not everybody's talking about Britain or France or Japan, you know, but everybody talks about America, because if you scratch your left ear, it has big consequences all around the world. So you're the only ones in that position, and sometimes I think Americans are a bit freaked out by the extremity of reaction that everybody has about them. But that's because you are in the one remaining empire on the planet, so it really matters. It may not feel like an empire at home, but believe me, it does in Europe and lots of other parts of the world. We all care about America and what America is up to.
Well, at the same time, it gives you a lot more material.
Yeah.
I would hope so, anyway.
Yeah, well, you've given us endless material over the years. You continue to provide material at an astonishing rate. You know, the country is completely bewildering in its immensity and scale. And like I say, those consequences of something very small at home, I really don't think Americans understand that, how gripped everybody else is, how everybody watches and wonders what America is going to do next. It really is the kind of the first person almost you consult in world theater. That's the character you're watching, because they're the protagonist in lots of ways, and everything they do is going to affect everybody else on the stage. Which is, I suppose, a very unwanted position for a lot of Americans. They just want to get on with their lives. They're thinking about what's in front of them. And it must be a bit of a burden, actually.
But with suicide bombers, one of the things I don't understand is, what's in it for the women suicide bombers? Because with the men, you know, it's a very male kind of promise at the end of it, 72 virgins. A man, I think, thought of that. And but I bet you what women are offered is much more modest. It's probably, you know, flexible working hours and decent childcare at the end of it, something like that. Look at Vladimir Putin. How can he cultivates the idea of being a gangster? He just loves it. How can you trust anybody who looks like they've been cloned from a dead shark? Or Berlusconi in Italy, right? The envy of the world, Italy, in terms of history, art and culture. 98 different political parties, and they still managed to elect him. He's so crooked, he sleeps on a spiral staircase.
What are some of your favorite targets, if you will?
Well, you know, I don't know if I call them targets, because I'm not interested in attacking something for its own sake. I'm interested in what I'm interested in, and what I'm interested in tends to be my own life, my own experience, and what I see intersects or overlaps with what I imagine most people's experience is, because I have to deal with what's universal. I'm traveling around in all these different zones, you know, from Britain to Poland to Germany to Russia to America or Australia. So these are all, you know, fairly different environments in some ways. Some are superficial and not and trivial, and some quite important. So I'm always drawn to the constants, you know, what people are talking around as they sit around their kitchen table, how people are dealing with children. What, I mean, if you look at the concerns of people all around the world, you know, say, just to go back to politics for a second, when all the politicians are out there before an election, what people are worried about is all the very, very obvious stuff that they mention all the time: their energy bills, feeding and clothing their families, educating their kids, their children having a better experience than themselves. That's really it, you know, most of the time for most people. So that inevitably a lot of what you talk about is going to be around those areas, because that's where all our big myths and stories come from. You know, father figures and mother figures and the lover and the somebody who eloped. And it's these are the dramas of our lives that are played out in our kitchens and bedrooms. You know, it's not world consequential stuff. It's domestic drama, a lot of it.
Which country is least able to take a joke?
That's a good question, because there are places that are far more sensitive. I mean, Americans are actually fairly sensitive about what you say about them. And I always think that's very interesting, because you are such a strong country that there is this, you know, there's a lot of jingoism and a lot of insecurity, which is strange because you are so immensely powerful. But I think that's because there's a lot of self-doubt, actually, in America. And that's why you get these affirmations all the time. I'm always, you know, I always say this, I'm amazed at the amount of American movies. There was a big run of them recently where in the last reel, the character who's the president will be making some speech that always ends with the phrase, the American people, or, you know, because of the indomitable spirit of the American people. There's a lot of those movies, you know, where the White House was attacked or something like that. That features seems to loom large in people's imaginations at the moment in America. They feel like some sort of jig is up, or, you know, they're going to be called out or something like that. It seems to worry them. But, you know, there's lots of sensitivities. Like if you go, I was in Germany, you know, so I'm talking of people, you're talking English, people are sitting there, you know, they're thinking, what's he going to say about the war, about the Second World War? I was in Serbia last week. And certainly one way to get people's attention in a theatre in Serbia is to say, you know, in the rest of Europe, whenever Serbia comes up, we always say, that if you just say that to get that far, you won't hear a pin drop in the house. So yeah, everybody's concerned about what everybody else thinks about them is what I would say. You know, they're interested in what their neighbors say about them, or what their enemies have said about them over the years. I was in Kazakhstan and I said, you know, everybody laughs at somebody, so who do you laugh at here? And as one, the audience shouted out Kazakhstan, which I thought was very funny.
Well, why do you think there are not more Irish comedians?
Why do I think there are not more? Well, there are plenty. Do you want more? Do you want me to
sure.
Do you want me to call some people? Is this not working out for you?
I just want more.
There are actually plenty. I'm sure there are sites that people like you can go to.
Okay. Well, I think you're the one that has achieved the most notoriety.
Well, yeah. I don't know. I don't have a notoriety measuring instrument, but I know I've got around a bit for sure.
Yeah. When you decide on material for your routines, are you just constantly taking notes? Or are you just looking at everything?
I do take notes where and when I can. It can be hard when you're traveling, but I do try to take notes because often something will come to you and then it's gone and you won't get it back. It is anything and everything. You know, I scan newspapers, I talk to people. I find talking to people quite productive, actually, because you're speaking to someone who's in situ and dealing with that particular city, and they can tell you what's going on and what the big news was recently. And everybody's got an opinion. You don't have to force it out of people most of the time. The only time it's not really productive if somebody's trying to big up the place or sell you their city in some sort of touristy way. But if people just tell you what it's like to live there, it's always interesting.
Just as a last question, can you tell us about your deal with ABC Television?
I can tell you that I have a deal with ABC Television. Yeah. I'm going to deliver a pilot for a show before Thanksgiving, I think. And it's sort of set in and around, it's got to do with media and conflict. That's about as much as I can really say.
All right.
Modern news reporting.
Okay. We have some ideas here if you're looking for them.
Okay. All right.
All right. Dylan Moran, thank you for coming on.
Thank you very much.
I live in Scotland. Have you been to Scotland? See, that's the exact same number of people as answered that question in the affirmative when I ask it in England. And English people don't go up there. It's nearly half the country and they don't go up. And you say, why don't you go? And they go, oh, well, you know, it's very dark and dreary. Because they get so used to the crocodiles and the tropical storms down there in England. And they... dark and dreary, you can't understand the accent, the food's disgusting. A lot of violence, a lot of drugs, people injecting temazepam into each other's stumps. And otherwise, I'd go, you know. And
Irish comedian Dylan Moran chatted with Dan Harmon before a show last fall at Turner Hall Ballroom. You can find a link to more about him from wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That'll bring us to the end of another work week's worth of Lake Effect. Say that three times fast. We are produced by Stephanie Lecce, Dan Harmon, and Bonnie North, with production assistance from Eleanor Peterson, Nathan Royster, and Craig Worrell, as well as web support from Michelle Maternowski and studio engineering by John Strelecki. You've survived the polar vortex. Maybe this weekend you can put away your Gore-Tex. I'm Mitch Teich. Thanks so much for tuning in, and I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next.